This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. That revolution starts right now. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand. The Real Issue is a public affairs talk show, and we are here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m. This edition of The Real Issue is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by PlumbingSupply.com. Shop from the comfort of your home and have plumbing supplies delivered to your house by PlumbingSupply.com, your online plumbing supplier since 1995. So tomorrow night, the City of Chico's Planning Commission will meet to discuss the housing element of the city's general plan. The housing element outlines the housing needs for the city for the next 8 years or until 2030. So now last week, the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Bill Connolly, attempted to get a letter approved by the board that asks California Governor Gavin Newsom to omit Butte County from the state's prohibition against price gouging of rental properties. Also last week, Chico police began issuing notices for unhoused people to move their belongings from public spaces to sanctioned campgrounds or to the court-ordered pallet shelter. So all of these things happened within a week or so of each other, highlighting the fact that Chico needs to focus on housing. And that housing that is needed now, and on predicted housing needs for the future. The type of housing in the plan, in the general plan, in the housing element of the general plan will dictate the future of Chico and all of Butte County. So tonight on The Real Issue, we will spend the entire hour on the topic of housing. To talk about all things housing, I have on the phone with me Addison Winslow. Now, regular listeners of The Real Issue know Addison Winslow as a longtime advocate for unhoused people in Chico and abroad and for tenants' rights. Winslow is also now the housing and land use analyst for Butte Environmental Council. I am so happy to welcome you back to The Real Issue, Addison Winslow.
Hey, I'm super appreciative you invited me on.
Yeah. So Addison, I want to talk about a lot of things. We have a lot of time. This is not sound bites. This is not anything too, quick. So we have lots of time to sort of spread out. But I do want to start with the most urgent questions regarding housing. And that, of course, is price gouging, targeting renters. So just a tiny little bit of background. Since the campfire in 2018, there has been an ordinance in place that prohibits price gouging against renters. And this is because of the predicted rise in rental prices as their huge rise in demand, right? And the city of Chico, without any fanfare, allowed the ordinance to lapse in 2020. But that's not the end of the story. But I do want to pause for a second and ask you, Addison Winslow, talk about exactly what is price gouging and why would we have ordinances that would prohibit price gouging, particularly in emergency situations like immediately after the campfire?
Yeah, well, in a certain respect, rent always has like a little element of that because there's never enough housing to go around. Like we haven't really had that. It's always a little like a monopoly price where the rents are set less by like exactly how much it costs to bring a new rental unit on because that takes so long than it is how much do people have to pay. And it just got a lot more competitive after the campfire. We lost like 14,000 housing units, I believe in. And they were especially affordable ones, ones that were old or for whatever reason had gotten to the point where they were at a lower cost. So a lot of those people entered the Chico rental market, and sensibly enough, both the city of Chico and the state passed rent gouging, price gouging ordinances, specifically targeting rents. And I mean, they weren't wrong because even though that happened and anybody really paying attention would have known that or that's something that happened. It also happened when the Oroville Dam spillway, required the evacuation of the whole city. But a lot of landlords in some large companies too, companies that are well connected, they have like, you know, resources like attorneys that could have told them what they can and can't do, immediately went and sent out letters saying that due to market conditions, there were, you know, one from Hill Properties in particular that a friend of mine got emphasized how they're so sad that everything that's happened, you know, we all feel pain from this. And by the way, your rent's going up 15% if you want to stay living here. So this is all behind the scenes, the way that enforcement took place. There, Mike Ramsey, the DA, when he reported price gouging to him, what he described, he took an informational approach, which meant he called the landlord, told him you can't do that. I know one case because I was talking to people after the campfire, was canvassing, and I was outside of a grocery outlet, and I was told by the manager we weren't allowed to be there talking to people. But then I started talking to him about things, and he had been price gouged by his landlord. He called the DA. The DA told his landlord, you can't increase the rent like that. So then his landlord, in retaliation, tried to evict him from the place, and he called the DA again. The DA then called that guy and told, or the landlord, and told them that you can't evict them either. Now that would be presumed retaliation because it obviously was. So these protections save people's lives. Like when we think about, when we see the increase in homelessness that took place after the campfire, it would have been a lot worse if landlords were able to just have free rein with the emergency, you know, and just have like, let the entire onus fall on the backs of renters. So a lot of people were priced out just at 10%, but they couldn't go that far. There's also practices in a situation like that where landlords will raise rent so much on a particular tenant just to get them to leave because it's easier than actually filing eviction proceedings or attempting a no-cause eviction. And all of that has been, the stability has been held by this price gouging ordinance.
So it's based on what you're saying, you know, we have the district attorney, Mike Ramsey, who is taking, as you said, an informational approach. In other words, it's really complaint driven. So, for example, the guy that you spoke with at Grocery Outlet who called Mike Ramsey and said, hey, this is what's happening. Mike Ramsey calls the owner or the landlord or whatever and says, you can't do that. And so he tries to evict him and he has to call Ramsey again in order to stop that process from happening. So that requires somebody to be proactive. That requires somebody to understand their rights. It requires a whole lot, particularly from people that don't necessarily have the stability, don't have the resources, don't have the privilege of time to fight for their own needs. It sounds like if there's an ordinance in place, then the district attorney's responsibility is to help enforce that, it to help ensure that it is happening across the board. But as you have argued, it is not happening across the board. Talk about ways as you, and I know that you filed a complaint with the California Attorney General, Rob Bonta, on behalf of these practices. Talk about how these practices happen behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's regrettable, and it's maybe instructive in some kind of deeper reality with our police and code enforcement and district attorney and this whole apparatus that there really is no mechanism to proactively enforce that. I mean, it's a criminal offense to be sure. Price gouging is a misdemeanor. You can go to jail for it. And if I were to walk up and then take somebody's belongings and they catch me walking out with it, and they say, hey, that's mine. They say, oh, just kidding. You know, you informed me now that this is yours. I'm giving you this back. You'd still probably take me to jail. That's what you would expect for that kind of offense. But it doesn't apply the same to landlords. And not only would they not take you to jail, they would, utilize this informational approach. But they also, like, the police don't have anything to do with that. And actually this is lesson from history, and I talked to Ann Schwab, she was a council member. This was in when the Chico City Council voted to 7-0 to extend the price gouging ordinance at the end of 2019. And I complained to her as we're talking about that there hasn't been any proactive enforcement on this. And so I've talked to a lot of people that have experienced this, but they kind of don't really know what to do, or they don't have the self-confidence, or a lot of people are worried about retaliation and don't feel that they're protected well enough, understandably, so they don't report it. And she did, during that meeting, ask staff, and so it kind of came as council instruction to, and may have been included in a motion, that the city should help proactively enforce this ordinance. And what the city did was they put it on their website. They put it on the website for a very short time, and sometime during the pandemic, they just took it off, again, to little fanfare. And then later, the city's price gouging ordinance expired. And I also had contact with more city staff in the last year before I filed that report, maybe at the same time, to the attorney general about some local landlords that were on, you can see it on the internet, that they had raised the rental prices on these places in excess of 50% without any remodels or anything to justify it. I asked city staff if they would enforce this, if they had any mechanism doing it, if they planned to, and they told me that because the city's price gouging ordinance had expired, and that's just a state ordinance, they really didn't feel like it was their role or responsibility to enforce that, which isn't the way we deal with a lot of other state laws. Plenty of things the city doesn't have ordinances on the books for, but are still considered illegal, and the police or code enforcement still treat as illegal, but it's just not that way with price gouging.
Right. Right. And, you know, and for the record, I do want to sort of point out, I imagine that folks are out there saying, you know, if it's my apartment or it's my house and I would like to rent it to somebody else, it's my property and I should be allowed to raise the price. And if somebody doesn't want to pay that price, they're free to move somewhere else. And that's, you know, that's the libertarian approach. That's the idea of, hey, look, you're free to enter into this exchange or you're free to go someplace else. And I think the concern that we don't often think about is when you're in an emergency situation, for example, the campfire or the pandemic or a shelter crisis, which we have had for a very long time, mm-hmm. it is coercive to raise the rent. This is not a freely entered into exchange. And so just for folks to kind of think about that is that we are not freely engaging with each other. So just to mention, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have housing and land use analyst for the Butte Environmental Council, Addison Winslow, on the phone with me. We're talking about housing for this entire hour. So, Addison, you mentioned that in 2017, the Chico City Council, in a vote of 7-0, extended the price gouging ordinance. So you're not allowed to increase rental prices more than 10% annually. But then,
no, not annually. No, this is an absolute.
Oh, an absolute.
It's stronger rent control than they really have anywhere else in the country.
Oh, okay.
It's an emergency ordinance. Yeah, there's vacancy control in it, which means that if somebody moves out of a unit, you can't increase the price between tenants. Which normally rent, we have some rent controlled units in San Francisco or New York City,
right.
And they typically don't have vacancy control. So, you can jack up the rent whenever somebody moves out. So all you got to do is get your tenant out, and then you can do that. That's not the case with price gouging. It's actually stronger protections.
And we really and truly have been under emergency conditions since even before the campfire. But anyway, so then in 2020, it, as you mentioned, very unceremoniously lapsed, and the newly sworn in very conservative city council decided not to continue the price gouging protections, but then the state stepped in. Talk about that connection. The city said, nope, we're not going to do it, and then the state came in and said, yes, you will.
So Chico actually was under several overlapping emergency ordinances, and so the state has had emergency ordinances relating to fires actually since the year before the campfire, when there was the Kim Shi file in Santa Rosa had a very destructive wildfire in 2017,
right.
The year before. So Sonoma County is already under a price gouging ordinance, and Butte County was in 2018. And the state has been extending this, irrespective of what the city has done. And the state probably wasn't even keeping track of that. And then we also had emergency ordinances related to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we had several going on at the same time. We might still have that one going on. I really don't know. The fact that the city doesn't issue a press release saying we no longer are under this emergency, that one gives the city manager a specific role as director of emergency services, which allows them to do a lot more than they would otherwise be able to do. And I don't know that anybody knows whether we're really in that emergency still. But it's definitely complex times as a result of these just ongoing, like, fires, disasters, pandemics,
right.
in this area.
Right. So I want to move to one of the things that happened last week at the Butte County Board of Supervisors. So the governor has issued this as at the state level, there has a continuation about a price gouging ordinance. You can't just increase prices to make more money and to boot out people, especially when there's so few places, few other options where people can go. Last week, the Butte County Board of Supervisors, the chair, Bill Connolly, led an effort to get a letter written to the governor that says, kind sir, would you please exempt the Butte County from these protections? And so, in other words, what he was proposing is that Butte County should be allowed to price gouge. So talk about what happened at that meeting and where we stand in terms of those kinds of renter protections here in the county.
Well, we live in a thoroughly oppressive society. You can look at baby formula, there being a shortage, and gouging on that as evidence, or look at PG&E as evidence. And this is one specific circumstance that, because not even so much the severity of the impact of the fire as it is that nobody could really deny that it happened. And that's why we got these really exceptional protections to give some kind of stability for renters, for the majority of Chico, at the expense of landlords being able to do what they normally do, which is, you know, if they want to, squeeze as much as they can out of tenants, and having that ability. So now the supervisors, because they were asked by the North Valley Property Owners Association, have put forward this letter to exempt Butte County, like as if we were some kind of like a holdover absolutist monarchy in the European Union, that we just have special entitlement to these feudal privileges and to exercise them in a way that doesn't really match up with what the standards that the rest of the state abides by. When that meeting started, there were only two people there who were there to speak against it. It's hard to get to Oroville on a Tuesday morning, but Lauren Kennedy, who's the director of the North Valley Housing Trust, and I drove down there together to speak on it. And Todd Kimmelshue, the District 4 supervisor, asked if anybody in the room was an expert on the subject. And I gave kind of like a half and half things. It's my situation with a lot of matters. It's like, well, I know more than I think most people. I read the ordinance. I've been paying attention to this for several years now. And because in particular, the issue was in that letter, it's stated that what the county drafted at the behest of the Property Owners Association, that they're not able to maintain their properties because they can't increase costs. And that's very key to the issue. And if that were an issue, it's like, oh, it's not that they just want to see higher profits at the expense of these tenants who we know are struggling to make ends meet. But they actually want to keep things in good shape, and they're not able to because they don't have enough money coming in because all these other costs have increased, which is, it's true that contractor prices and some other materials and such have increased in the last several years. The thing is the price gouging ordinances do account for that. They don't want to tie providers of any kind of good or service in a situation where they have costs that come up and they're not able to increase the prices to meet that. So it would put them out of business. So landlords definitely don't need to go out of business. As Lauren and I both pointed out, there's a frequently asked questions page on the Attorney General's website about price gouging. And it states very clearly that if there are costs that you can account for, then you can raise the prices to match that in order to account for that. So you won't be put out of business. You shouldn't see any decline in your rate of return. And, you know, thankfully, well, we have the DA, Mike Ramsey, the only guy in the county that's going to enforce this thing, standing there, who went up and also spoke and said that's the truth. If anybody wants to increase prices because they have these costs that they're not able to meet, all they need to do is make sure you account for it. So you can point exactly to what costs went up and what you need to account for. I don't know why, you know, the supervisor's kind of like, you know, Todd Kimmelshue seemed to be like looking for that sort of information, you know, is like, are the details of this correct? Frankly, their letter is inaccurate, stating that they're not able to maintain properties as a result of this, but they still went forward with it anyway. It's not really a matter of getting the right information out there. It's kind of I would call it a raw power grab, but they're asking the governor to do this. And it's at the governor has the power to do it or not. I don't think they were interested in actually having the information that they can raise the rents if they need to, if they can account for it.
Well, what's curious is the fact that they're writing this letter that says we would like to be exempt from this price gouging ordinance. But apparently, Supervisor Kimmelshue had not actually read the ordinance. If he was asking for somebody in the public to explain the ordinance to him. And you would think that if he were to sign his name or to vote to have the chair sign his name on this letter, that he would thoroughly have read the ordinance, done the research, and actually come prepared to that meeting. But instead, he just asks, I don't know, does anybody know what's going on? And luckily for you and for Lauren Kennedy, you stepped up and said, well, this is what's in there. And your analysis was backed up by the Butte County District Attorney, Mike Ramsey. And then ultimately, he voted for this letter asking the governor to exempt the county from price gouging anyway, protections anyway. So it seems like homework is not being done at the supervisor's level, so which is unfortunate.
Sometimes what matters less is what the reality is or the answers or the correct information than it is who's pressuring and for what reasons.
And what do you mean by that? Go on.
I mean, the North Valley Property Owners Association are people with lots of money and power, and that has a lot more to do with the way that politics operates often,
right,
than what's correct or even what makes the most sense from an economic stability standpoint.
Right. And it would be interesting to know how much money the North Valley Properties Association has contributed to various campaigns. So I do want to say, for the record, in terms of asking the governor to exempt Butte County from these price gouging protections, Supervisor Deborah Lucero and Supervisor Tammy Ritter voted against that request. Supervisor Bill Connolly, Supervisor Todd Kimmelshue voted for that request, and Supervisor Doug Teeter was absent. So the vote was 2-2. And Addison Winslow, I assume that this question will be brought up at the next meeting when all five of the supervisors are present.
That's my assumption. Yeah.
And based on the history of this board, it is assumed that this will pass and that a letter will be requesting. What can people do in order to respond to that sort of request? I mean, like you submitted a letter to the a complaint, I should say, to the California Attorney General's office, and so that's one way that you could go about doing it. What did you do? What was in your complaint?
Well, in that case, this is to be sure, North Valley Property Management was the company, and this is all me as an individual that was doing this. This was long before I had any relationship with Beck on a formal basis, and is completely independent of any of my work that is with the Environmental Council. But on Zillow, they have these rental listings, and you can see on there how what they used to rent something as, what they rent it as now. I also know individuals who had, North Valley Property Management had been reported to the district attorney for some of their practices. It's not just rent gouging in like the purest, most obvious form, but adding on surcharges or what they call tenant benefit packages. They were in addition to rent, but were mandatory to pay. And they had been required to reduce some of those things. But you could still see all these units that there's nobody really to like recognize, like, I'm being price gouged right now, because they're moving into a new place and they didn't know what that place was being rented for before. And I'm sure there's a lot more of this going on. I'm sure many landlords are more intelligent than whoever decided to put all that out in the open on Zillow. But it was out in the open, so I took some pictures and I submitted it in a report on the Attorney General's website. There's a form you can fill out.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Addison Winslow, who is a longtime advocate for renters and also for unhoused folks. I do want to mention, just in case you have forgotten sort of the history of any of this, I just want to remind you that Chico's shelter crisis, it is not new. And it's so not new that it happened that the shelter crisis declaration was first declared and adopted by the Chico City Council before the campfire. So when we often think about this housing crisis, we sort of think back to 14,000 homes being lost during the campfire in 2018. But a month before that, the shelter crisis declaration was passed by the city council, and that action was led by the conservative Republican mayor at the time, Sean Morgan. So the shelter crisis was declared a second time just last summer with the action led by current conservative Republican Mayor Andrew Coolidge. So the fact that the shelter crisis is still in place shows that we are still living in this emergency situation. So it's not that we don't need this anymore. We don't need renter protections anymore. The conservative Republican-led city council extended the shelter crisis because they recognize, and if you didn't even know that, you just look out the window and see folks that are living in these encampments around our city because we are in the middle of a crisis. So once again, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. Addison Winslow, I do want to just keep plowing forward. I'm looking at the time. I'm tempted to take a quick music break, but there's still so much that we need to talk about. And so we're going to bypass that for the moment. I'm looking at all my questions and you are a wealth of information. So I don't want to do that. So, anyway, okay. So the fact that Chico still has a shelter crisis, it means that housing must be built. And so what I want to do is turn to the issue of Chico's growth. Where do we need to grow? And a general plan is required by all counties and all cities so that each, you know, municipality, each county can plan for the future in terms of providing services that are needed by the folks and projected population growth. And one part of the general plan is the housing element. And so first, before we get too far involved into the weeds, Addison, talk about what's included in the housing element of a general plan and how that element relates to the other elements of a general plan.
Okay, so I'm going to step back just to do a segue.
Okay.
Here. When we're talking about the fact that rent gouging is coercive, because it's not something where this is a voluntary service that's offered and voluntarily accepted, there really aren't enough places to go. Just one more example of that is in today's Enterprise Record, Paul Hahn, the interim city manager, talked about how RVs are being cleared out.
Right.
And the RVs are not permitted, or anybody who lives in an RV is not permitted in the city's shelters. Other people are prioritized because there are so many of them. And there isn't a place to go. And he says that, and eerily similar to the Sean Morgan talking on the radio, mentioning that people have nowhere to go, but we're hoping that they'll leave town eventually. It is a situation where we don't have enough housing as it is. But on top of that, is you can't just build housing anywhere. So people who have land, you're not necessarily allowed to just set up some shacks in your backyard and let people have them. We have building code. We have zoning. All these things are limitations on people's ability to be housed somewhere or to house somebody else somewhere. And that's really what the housing element has to do with. It's a state-mandated element to the general plan. The reason the state mandates it is because cities have a history of trying to use zoning powers. It's a kind of policing powers where it originates with you have your industrial uses, which can be a nuisance to your residential areas. And in the 1930s, it was firmly decided by the Supreme Court that apartments can be considered a nuisance. So we started saying where you can and cannot have multifamily unit houses. So things, not just apartments, but townhouses, duplexes, every form of house except for a single family house on a large lot. Now, then came with conditions of where it can happen, and what needs to happen in order for it to be considered right, what you need to pay in order for it to be considered okay. So the housing element is where cities have to argue to the state that they're not going beyond the extent of the law in suppressing multifamily housing, suppressing housing for low-income people in particular.
So go on with that, because I did see that article in the paper this morning. I'm happy that you brought it up. And just for listeners, as we see the pallet shelter, people are moving into the pallet shelter. We're also seeing there's a few other campgrounds. Some of them are contentious and they're not being used quite yet. But there is a sanctioned campground where people are being moved out of public spaces and public view, really. But there was an article in the paper this morning at the Comanche Creek area where there's lots of RVs there. And what the city is trying to do is move them, but they have no place for them to move. And those RVs are not allowed in the pallet shelter. So where are these folks supposed to go? So, Addison, I do want to get back to the general plan, the housing element of the general plan, but I actually think it would be more strategic for us to talk about that after I ask you to talk about, give us a little bit of a of the history of how Chico has developed. And I think it's difficult for folks to say, well, this is what my community looks like. What are we supposed to do now? So if you give us a sense, put us in context of how did the city develop it? And I would love to hear if you would include population centers and transportation corridors, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is where the understanding of the environmental angle, and there's not, it's not just the in environmental considerations, but it has to do with a lot of what makes a city good or sustainable, is that the way that development's been tied to transportation. And you, so you can see it, and most people in Chico are probably roughly familiar, will recognize these phases of Chico's development, how it's created these different areas we know, the first being downtown and South Campus. It's on a grid. All the streets are on a grid. They're very small blocks. They were designed for people who walked. You had like horse carriages that would go, wagons that would go down Main Street. And so it was a little bit wider. But generally, that's the way that everybody got around was walking. And so everybody lives in a compact center. You know, we had multi-story buildings from the start that even some areas we don't have anymore. And at the time, the turn of the 20th century and the Diamond Match Company coming in particular, Chico saw a lot of growth. And this is something, it's common to the urban pattern of cities across North America, that we had streetcars, electric streetcars, and they went down these arterial roads, so kind of wider roads that would stretch out. And people lived along those streetcar routes within generally about four blocks, like something like a quarter mile is what people would generally be comfortable walking every day to take the streetcar to their place of work, which could be some of the factories at the end of the streetcar lines, like the Diamond Match Factory down south, or the what's now Chico Nut up on north end of the good Esplanade Boulevard.
Right.
And after World War II, again, this isn't just a story of Chico, but it's a story of cities throughout North America. People started to develop around the automobile. And first it was the more affluent sections of the population. But very quickly it cut down on the ridership for the streetcars. And so Chico streetcar, I believe the last ride was like 1947. And there was freight still going down, but the passenger streetcar stopped servicing very shortly after World War II. And very quickly after that, we started extending into these other areas. So at first, like north of Bidwell Park, was called the Longfellow neighborhood. The city had to extend sewers out there in order to make it work, but they developed around people relying on the automobile. Very, very quickly, we ran into a situation in Chico where downtown was still a center of economic activity, but it didn't really like work with everybody driving cars. And this has been probably the central issue in Chico's development since then, is that in order to see more housing or more economic activity, it comes with all this like automobile issues. And so we have parking impact, and we have we used to call it level of service at intersections. That's how you measured transportation impact, traffic congestion, and generally whenever a development is proposed and you see neighborhood pushback, it centers around these things of every person comes with a car. And this has been the case just since after World War II, and it really came into being more and more as the 20th century went on. And it's something that we haven't quite broken out of yet. Chico didn't have any public transportation system from the end of the passenger streetcar until the 1970s, when a bunch of liberals won the city council, and one of their demands they won was to form a bus system in Chico, which was called Chico Area Transportation System, CATS, which I think sounds cooler than Beeline. But
right.
But so they run these buses down what are the old streetcar arterials, like Park Avenue and Esplanade. So we have all these areas that sprawled out very quickly after World War II. Up until like the 1990s when we started developing a little bit more intelligently, started having some community design concerns. And, we had standards at that point for stuff like trees and parking lots. So if you look at Southeast Chico, like along East 20th, you'll see that there's a lot more trees around than maybe Mangrove,
right,
or North Esplanade, the North Valley Plaza. And that's related to the era of development that happened at and what kind of standards we had for for the development that went on. In so this general plan that we have now, we've had since 2011, has, you know, the plan is, and the community emphasis, what the city council wanted at the time and what most people in all these community meetings wanted was to not just build outwards, you know. In 1980, we got the Green Line, which prevents Chico from sprawling westward into more agricultural territory to preserve the prime farmland, but it has tons of alternative benefits in having a compact urban form that's more efficient financially. It's easier for people to walk around, generates better community. And then we've also been blocking developments in the foothills. So there was a Bidwell Ranch that was shot down by a ballot initiative just north of Bidwell Park. And then we're still seeing some of the same things happening with Valley's Edge. Very consistent themes in Chico's development history as it goes on. But so people wanted for Chico to develop more inward. We wanted to see infill and redevelopment. Those are like the key words there. And where Chico decided to orient to that redevelopment was we always want to see downtown grow back up. We used to have six-story hotels downtown. They've been demolished in our parking lots now. And the community in general would like to see that downtown be kind of re-intensified, to where we have a little more, more activity going on there, more housing. But then there's also these corridor opportunity sites is what they're called. They're underutilized transportation corridors. And that would be North Esplanade, Mangrove, Nord Avenue. They picked just a few, and they're mostly areas that are uncomfortable to be on. It's like low density commercial uses. It's pretty hostile to pedestrians or bicyclists being outside, and it's really undesirable pieces of land. And the hope was that some developers wanting to build high density housing in Chico would find sites on these corridors, and they would build, you know, multi-story housing with ground floor commercial, and that in the process the city would get the money to then redesign these corridors to be something that's a little more visually appealing, like the Esplanade, which is not included as a corridor opportunity site. Only north of the Lindo Channel to Eaton Road is. So the situation we're at since the general plan that came in 2011 is that hasn't worked really well. We haven't had redevelopment in these areas. I could venture to guess why, because they're unpleasant places to be on, and who wants to invest millions of dollars in building an apartment building somewhere that nobody likes to be?
Right. Addison, you explain this so clearly, and for me, what it comes down to is transportation completely determines how we develop. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have people that want to be downtown. Downtown, I mean, in any community, downtown is the place to be. It's a walking area. You can sit outside and you can drink coffee and you can, you know, leisurely go window shopping or whatever, hang out in the park downtown. The problem is, if you have to drive downtown, you have to park downtown, and that means we have big parking lots in the middle of downtown that detracts. Mm-hmm. So it's this weird sort of irony of how to build a good, walkable, livable community when we absolutely insist on having cars and parking and so on. One of the things that you have talked about a lot and what you say people in Chico really want is that we want to have more density, because if we had better transportation, if we had better designed communities, then we wouldn't necessarily need cars because we could walk, we could bike more often. So talk about how do we identify areas, and I know that you are very clear on where those areas are within the city limits that you see are prime areas for infill.
So just to be sure, this is what our housing element draft does. And if you look up that draft and you go to something like page 246 on it, there's a map that shows the sites for low-income housing. And they're looking in particular at vacant sites because redevelopment takes a little bit more. You know, you have to discontinue the use that it has rather than it just being an empty lot that's like free for the taking, and that they can build on. And the reality is that Chico has very few infill sites left. They name 15 sites here, but it's really more like 12 because some of them are right next to each other. About 12 places where low-income housing can be built left in Chico inside city limits that are just open and they're zoned correctly. And so redevelopment would be like putting a building on a parking lot. And that means you lose that parking.
Right.
You know, you can try and replace it somewhere else, but ultimately, I think that's the direction that we have to go in, is having downtown be more transit accessible, be more bikeable, be more walkable, and have less of a need for people in order to access that environment to come via private automobile. So where are the sites? Where should the sites be? Is that what you asked?
Yes, let me jump in and say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Addison Winslow on the phone with me, and we are talking about all different aspects of housing where we're talking about in Chico. What we're talking about right now is, here we are, the city general plan, the rewriting and the adoption of the Chico general plan is very close. It will come before the Planning Commission tomorrow night, and what we're talking about is right now is what's needed and how we plan for the future, so that the end result of this plan and the implementation of the plan results in a livable city, a city that we enjoy, that we actually love to be in. So, Addison, yeah, if you talk about where, first of all, what my real question is, where have the infill sites been identified, so that we have a sense of, you know, where they are in terms of the downtown area where people tend to want to be, but also, is that enough for the predicted growth in Chico between now and 2030?
So predicted growth is really difficult to ascertain. Chico's experiencing perhaps even a population loss at this very moment, just because housing is so inaccessible for people.
Right.
That won't necessarily continue to be the case, and we hope that it won't. But we do have this state process for distributing, for estimating how many people are going to need to live in a place, how many housing units are going to be necessary. And that's what the city is trying to argue here, is that they're willing to accommodate. They've zoned enough land to accommodate all the people that will move to Chico in the next 8 years. And where I think we have issues, there's a lot of different ones, but in particular with these sites, is that they're mostly in outlying areas of town, mostly on like high traffic roads, as if, you know, the apartments would just be sound buffers to this sort of the real neighborhood that exists behind them. And these areas are like, for example, North Esplanade, north of Eaton Road, where if you go on Esplanade past Eaton Road, you'll notice there's no sidewalk along there. Where Chico loves to put the highest density housing is between the Highway 32 and the railroad track. There's several sites there. One of them is actually a commercially farmed orchard. We see West East Avenue. The speed limit there, I think, is like 45 miles an hour.
Hmm.
And then there's a couple that are on Highway 32 leaving town eastward. So before you get to Bruce Road, between Forest Avenue and Bruce Road, there's these big open fields out there. And they, according to this, there will be some high-density housing out there at
mm-hmm,
some point.
Mm-hmm.
And a major issue with that one is there's vernal pools on site. So there's endangered species out there likely that will probably be a constraint to development. There aren't any sites in downtown. And I think that is perhaps the biggest environmental problem with the way that this housing element looks. Chico, in our general plan, has a plethora of policies that support redevelopment in the center city, supports intensification, densification of downtown, supports transit-oriented development. But none of the sites in here that they're committing to, like the city is pretty well determined. Well, they won't make it happen, but they ought to help make happen the development of these sites. They're not looking at downtown. And it's not because they're not anticipating development downtown. And there's a parking lot by what's called Lost Park on the north end of downtown. It's usually where you would park to go to the Saturday Farmers Market.
Yep.
That has a proposal for a development in conjunction with the university right now. The thing is, they're just not planning on putting any housing there, or any low-income housing, at least. It's not listed as a site. The Chico State wants conference center space, and they want a place for people to stay when they go to a conference center. So they're not anticipating using that to solve our housing needs. Very, very nearby, there's a big vacant lot next to Northern Star Mills. Decently sized vacant lot next to Northern Star Mills on Memorial, across from some county buildings. That's zoned medium-density residential, so you could have up to 14 units an acre on it. Which is not a whole lot. That would be like a small apartment building, rather than, you know, being next to downtown. You got to have multiple stories there.
So, Addison Winslow, one proposed development that is pretty controversial, and of course that's Valley's Edge. And you know, it's a very low density. It's very expensive. The environmental impact report indicates that the drive to the foothills will contribute to air pollution, and of course it's going to contribute to urban sprawl, which brings up its own set of issues in terms of maintaining the roads. We can barely maintain the existing roads, much less the impact on this new development. And so, I mean, this type of development is very typical of the unlimited development model since really the 1950s. I mean, it's incredibly outdated. That's what's being planned. That is the large housing projects. And what you're saying is there's not all that much land opportunities for affordable housing, or even quality city center places to develop. So if Valley's Edge is not quite right, but there's not a lot of space in the city to develop, how do we think about growing the community, providing the housing that is desperately needed? And again, as we look back on this time, say, yep, we built a livable city. What is the answer?
So there are places where we can develop affordable housing anywhere you look in Chico, but it means redeveloping. It means taking something that's already there and making it higher, making it more productive, making it more of like a social space, contribute more to the community. And like you mentioned, all along the, you know, off of Main and Broadway, there's parking lots all up and down downtown.
Right.
Many of them are city owned. They certainly could be redeveloped into something. And then in the areas around there, Chico, primarily in the Barber neighborhood and the avenues and Chapmantown and up along Bidwell Park, all these areas are zoned low density. They don't allow apartments there. They're considered a nuisance. And we haven't come around to saying that housing is more important, or that you know, like economic viability for a city, the ability to maintain our sewers and our roads is more important than saying that, you know, you are forever, your neighborhood is forever encased in amber and will never change. We'll never see more people develop. There will never be young people living or families able to live in your neighborhood again. And a huge part of that, like to circle back, is the association of new housing with car traffic,
mm-hmm.
and the inability to decouple the two. And it's really the greatest impediment to new housing that we have, because we have mandatory off-street parking minimums. Before you can build any unit of housing, you need to consider that somebody's got to put a car somewhere. And you can't just consider that car can go in front of the house on the street. That doesn't count according to the city of Chico. I think that's an outdated sort of draconian policy from the mid-20th century that we really need to do away with, just like the Main and Broadway couplets in downtown is outdated, and those streets should be more for people to ride bikes and play outside or something like that, enjoy themselves.
Let me ask you this. I hear you, and as I was listening to you, I can imagine all of the areas just on my drive, not my bike, but on my drive to the station, and even up further on Esplanade, there are so many places that need to be redeveloped. All up along Park Avenue, all of that could be very, very interesting redevelopment. And then even Chico Nut, I mean, that could be a very cool community gathering spot if it's properly designed. But I think the struggle is it's very expensive to do that. And unless it is public money that is being invested to do that redevelopment, there's not a developer, a for-profit developer, that would invest, as far as I can tell. How do we do that? How do we redevelop those areas that are really eyesores and are a waste of space in terms of creating more density and just creating a more livable community?
So the city certainly can contribute resources to that. And even if it's not directly, even in the purchasing of land or in financing a development, the city does contribute to development. And development on a large scale doesn't happen without city support for it. What the city does, however, is they pull either state grants or their own resources to widen roads at the end of town in order for these sprawl developments to occur.
Okay.
That's where a lot of the city's resources are going for infrastructure. It's to like increase the ultimate burden that we have of this infrastructure by widening Bruce Road or widening Cohasset.
Right.
There are several other roads. There's a new Southgate interchange being planned on the south end of town, and that funds and that energy could be directed towards addressing the barriers to redevelopment. And there are different barriers depending on where you're looking. But most certainly there are some developers in town who can do that type of stuff. We actually have very few. Most of the developers in town prefer to do single story, single family houses just because that's what their grandfather did. But we do have Modern Building, for example, does multi-story projects. Mm. And, there was a proposal for, the Graduate property. This is on 8th and Normal,
right.
Which is technically in downtown, to develop. As far as I know, it's the highest density development that was ever proposed in Chico. It's to be six stories, a real five over one is what you call that. It's to be student housing with a little cafe on the bottom. The city's Historical Preservation Architecture Review Board asked them to put in more parking. The city staff then proposed to the Planning Commission, while it's unclear if anybody ever expected this would apply to that project, they wanted to shrink the area in downtown where instead of providing parking on site, you can pay for spaces in the parking structure, saying that it was never intended to apply to these and assuming that just that there would be some catastrophic effect to building housing for students, even though you can see the university from outside, it's just down the street, you know, and that's where they're going, right? Even though that adding that kind of more people there, that increases the market share where some little stores nearby could actually be providing like more of like a full service grocery store. The co-op is nearby already. Though they decided that the priority was to not try to negatively impact the parking in the area. This is applied to a lot of other areas. Just one more example there on 4th and Main. This is across street from the plaza, what was formerly Campus Bike. There was an approved project to put two stories of housing on top of that building. As I heard, not sure of the details, but the parking fees was the issue that led to them changing that project. They're now doing a single-story commercial with a parking lot on site.
So,
and these are just the choices that we have to make and prioritize certain things in order to get the result that we want.
Addison Winslow, I have about 30 seconds left. You finally, through my thick skull, I understand what you're talking about. And essentially what it sounds to me is there are city resources, but the money is being spent on, you know, maintaining and creating more urban sprawl. And so instead of doing that and redirecting it, it sounds like that's what the general plan does. So in 30 seconds, let us know how people can be involved and have their voices heard in the creating, in the crafting and adoption of a general plan. 30 seconds.
Partly, we have a good general plan as it is, but the general plan policies really are not being enforced, and that's a political decision. But part of that means that people need to come out and speak on behalf of these things. If you really want to get involved and know more, what I'm working on with the Environmental Council right now is part of a broader project. Called the Chico Green City Campaign or something like that. Green City of the North State is a phrase from the general plan, and we're saying we'd like to see this vision be realized in practice in the city. So contact the Environmental Council or donate, become a member, and show up to some things, and you'll find yourself in the right place to help participate in making Chico a more green city.
Addison Winslow, you are a rock star. As always, thank you so much for your time.
I really appreciate you and your show, too.
You got it. I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right. This brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar serves lunch and dinner with curbside pickup and offers delivery through Entree Express. They also have vegan and gluten-free offerings. Open 7 days a week from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. They're located at 2359 on the Esplanade in Chico. For details, find Farmstar Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. You got to turn in your ballots by Tuesday. If you haven't done it yet, do it now. I just read that a statewide 10% of people have turned in their ballots.